Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, September 6th, 2001. In the Creekside room this morning is Don Eisminger with Carl Foss. Today's session number is ISL 2001-4, and it's titled M2 Program, Man to Man, Woman to Woman. Let's listen in.
I'd send to our prison community is a program that we call M2. And this morning you should have picked up three pieces back there. There's enough for everyone, I think, about the M2 program. There should be three pieces back there. On the end over here, on the right end. On the right end.
Yes.
Okay, very good. This week we have been looking at a variety of features of prison ministry, trying to encourage people who belong to Christian congregations that there indeed is something that they can do. There are a variety of ways to minister to these people. And I want to emphasize the fact that they are people, and that they have families who are deeply affected by their incarceration. Tomorrow, the topic is going to be, what on earth does salvation mean? And in preparation for that, I have a sermon here that I want you to take with you and read. You may not agree with everything in it. That's okay. The governor of South Dakota knows me because of my work in the penal system, and he happened to meet my son, who works for a large seed company. And so he said, "So Leroy is your father, huh?" "Yeah, he's liberal as hell, but he's still a good man." Our governor is a Republican and exceptionally conservative, and you may feel that you agree with him after you read something like this and after you hear tomorrow morning. But how many of you got a close friend?
How many what?
Real close friend that you can just bare your soul to. Yeah. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I kind of turned the hymn around. What a Jesus we have in a friend. All our sins and griefs to bear, they carry. What a privilege to carry everything to our friend. Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear. All because we don't carry everything to our friend. Have we trials and temptations? Is there trouble anywhere? We should never be discouraged. Take it to our friend. Can we find a friend so faithful? Who will all our sorrows share? Our friends know our every weakness, so we take it to them in prayer. 70%, a survey recently done in 2001 spring, among clergy, and it was discovered that over 70% of all clergy that were questioned say they do not have a close friend. I find that very sad. Sometimes I suppose it could be by choice, but many times a pastor moving into a strange community, accepting the call to a new church, finds it very difficult to establish friendships. People in congregations sometimes watch it very closely. They become conscious of the fact that the pastor seems like he's spending too much time with a particular family. And so it's one of those realities of life. But I want to tell you today about over 2 million people in our prison system. In the United States, many of them do not have a friend. And we want this morning to talk to you about what it means to be a friend to someone in prison and the value of it. This summer, I went to a congregation and they asked me to have a children's sermon. And so I brought along this little folder here, and I had the children come up, and I gave a whole bunch of them to me of them, and I said, I want you to pass them out after I talk to you. And so I asked the children, what is a prison? And the answer I got from some who all kind of spoke up at once, prison is a place where bad people go. What do you suppose they got at that idea? Yeah. And when I am given that answer, I have the opportunity to correct them. Because I'm sure that this is an answer that they have learned from their adults around them. And that particular Sunday, I said this. I want to correct you. Prison is a place where good people who have done some terrible things, made some bad choices, violent choices, sometimes even insane choices. It's where those good people who have done that go. Prison is a place where good people who have made poor choices go. And then I ask them, how many of you have done something you shouldn't do? And in a Lutheran church, there will probably be about three who will raise their hands. And so then I ask these people, when you did something bad, did that make, when you did something you weren't supposed to do, did that make you bad, a bad person? And you know how these little kids respond to that. I mean, they're not going to take that. No, I'm still a good person. And that's the way it is. God has made us all good. Genesis says at the end of chapter 2, and God looked at everything he had made, and behold, it was very good. The Hebrew word there is tov, T-O-B, meaning beautiful. Good is a translation of that, but it would be more correct to say everything that God made is beautiful. I got a letter back that next week from somebody who had been in the church. I am writing because of one statement you made that surprised me. You talked of the folks in prison as good people making poor choices. I want you to know that I don't think that that is biblical. We are all sinful and fall short of the glory of God. I do not consider myself a good person, but a very sinful one. These folks have chosen to sin against God. I do not think our prisons are peopled with good people making wrong choices, but with sinful people who chose to follow their will instead of God's. Now, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about that? You agree with it? Maybe you do.
We're all sinful people.
You can pick up three things back there on the table.
Seems to me it's semantics.
It could be semantics.
I think it's an issue of definition, I think. I wouldn't get hung up on it.
No. Paul, you know, you're the expert on Paul, but he says all of us have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And that's true. And yet, we are the creation of God. We are the person who created God. And I want to, the thing that I want to impress people with is that prisoners are human beings. When a man came to my office, I never asked him what he did. I wasn't interested in that for two reasons. Number one, I believe that it was something that maybe he wanted to keep to himself. I wasn't going to be nosy. And then secondly, I believe that God had forgiven him. I believe in the forgiveness of sins. And so I didn't ask them that. But in prison, they become dehumanized. They become a number. And I don't know, Carl, if you have found it that way in your work with prisons, but very often, dehumanizing terms are used for inmates. What is a place called out in the hinterland that has a person waiting to come into the prison called? In South Dakota, they're called holding pens. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when they come into a certain section of the prison and the person who is in charge of that particular section of the prison gets together with somebody, how many head did you get today? What's a new inmate called? In our prison, they're called fish.
Fish.
Oh. Fish. We got 70 fish today. And what they mean by that is, I suppose it's because they all wear orange suits when they first come in. Goldfish. So yeah, everybody knows that they're new because for several weeks until they get processed through the system, they have to wear these orange coveralls. And everybody knows that they are new. And they become a number. It's really, what are the doors called in a prison?
Gates.
Gates. Gates, heard and true. They become dehumanized. One man said, like a snake shedding its skin, your identity starts to peel away, and instead of being called a parent, a student, a son, a husband, or a truck driver, the label of convict that I was given that night began to define me. And one of the results of having those 12 people come every Thursday night to our worship service was that it changed their view of who these inmates were. These men that society had labeled as animals take on a face. And people out in the parking lot afterwards would tell me, that young man who helped you with communion tonight, he reminded me of my grandson. And I said, well, he is somebody's grandson. It takes on a face, and many of them said, I wasn't prepared for how young they are. Our prison has men come in young men who've been tried as adults so that they can experience an adult punishment. 14-year-olds come to our prison, 14 and 15-year-olds. And what I would like to have you do is to take out this sheet that says M2 Program Philosophy. Number 3 on the bottom of the page. Let's read it together. With public sentiment, that's this one here. On the top of the page it says M2 Program Philosophy. With public sentiment, against crime running high, there is morally apathy towards prison involvement that must be overcome. There is outright community hostility which focuses on crime and is enhanced by constant media attention from the immediate area and reported from across the country. Prisoners are human beings. And that's what we want you to understand today, is that there is a way in which you can minister to what we call the forgotten fifth. In Matthew 25, Jesus mentions 5 groups of people, and the last group he mentions are prisoners. The church has all kinds of institutions to help the hungry. To go to the hospitals, we have Lutheran hospitals, we have Presbyterian hospitals, Catholic hospitals for the sick. For refugees, we have refugee resettlement. For those who are cold, we build Habitat for Humanity houses for them, and we make quilts in our church, but what do we do for the prison inmate? And virtually very little. And today I have asked a man to come to talk to us about the M2 program. I want to tell you that in South Dakota, our recidivism rate is between 25 and 30%. It kind of goes back and forth. But those inmates who have had an M2, a friend like you, their return rate to the prison is less than 0.5%. It shows the power of friendship, of what it means to an inmate to have someone like you come and become a part of their life. And when I was coming out here, our M2 coordinator, Don Clausen, learned that I was coming out here because I asked him for some of these folders to share with you. And he said, "Say, I know a man that lives out in Washington. His name is Carl Foss, and you better have him come." Well, Carl graduated from Stadium High School in Tacoma. He was discharged with honors after 4 years in the Air Force during the Korean War. Graduated from Pacific Lutheran University, attended Fuller Theological Seminary. His past experience includes working for Washington State in the prison system and vocational rehabilitation, founding and directing One to One, a nonprofit evangelical Christian ministry to prisoners of all ages in Washington State Institution. He was a realtor for 8 years and Life Manor administrator for 9. He initiated and did much work, the groundwork for the new assisted living facility. He's been a licensed pastor since 1987 and an ordained minister with the Assemblies of God since 1995. His wife is Carol. They've been married for 43 years. They have 5 grown children and 10 grandchildren. His wife is the Life Center Music Department Secretary. So I'd like to have you welcome Carl Foss. Now, before we forget, don't leave this room without it. Well, that phrase for our express card, don't leave this room without this. Okay.
Well, I like to start with a little levity, if I may. Since Leroy was sitting down, I guess I'll sit down too, so I have an idea. This was something that was made up years ago, and I don't know if you ever heard this, Leroy. I'm just going to read it from this. It's called Going Through Channels. It's a memo from the warden to the associate warden. I sometimes was acting warden of the Correction Center at Shelton, Washington. Tomorrow evening at approximately 8 p.m., Halley's Comet will be visible in the area, an event which occurs only once every 75 years. Have the men file out in the yard area in white t-shirts, and I will explain this rare phenomenon to them. In case of rain, we will not be able to see anything, so assemble the men in the theater, and I will show films of it. Now it goes from the memo from the associate warden to the chief correctional supervisor. By order of the warden, tomorrow at 8 p.m., Halley's Comet will appear above the yard area. If it rains, follow the men out in t-shirts. Then march to the theater area where the rare phenomenon will take place, something which occurs once every 75 years. Then it goes from the associate warden to the chief correctional supervisor to the correctional supervisor. By order of the warden in t-shirts at 8 p.m. tomorrow evening, the phenomenon Halley's Comet will appear in the theater. In case of rain in the yard area, the warden will give another order, something which occurs once every 75 years. Then it goes from the correctional supervisor to the unit officers. Tomorrow at 8 p.m., the warden will appear in the theater with Halley's Comet, something which happens every 75 years. If it rains, the warden will order the comet into the yard area. Then it goes from the unit officer to the residents themselves, the prisoners. When it rains tomorrow at 8 p.m., the phenomenal 75-year-old Officer Haley, accompanied by the warden, will drive his comet through the yard office theater in his t-shirt. Have you ever heard that before?
No,
I thought that was something years ago. I picked that one up. Well, putting all seriousness aside, I always like to let you know as concise as possible what we're talking about here on a one-to-one basis. I call my new project 141 because Jesus said, insofar as we do it to one of the least, including the prisoner, we're doing it to him, so we're doing it one for one. He said one. You know, if you talk to two prisoners together, often it's hard to break through on a relationship level. Because they have to hold up this kind of tough guy facade, you know. But I found from my experience working with somewhere near 50 to 100,000 convicts in the last 40 years, which anybody can do, I just happen to do it, but on both an official level and a volunteer level, that you can get through to almost any convict that is open to receiving you as a friend on a relationship basis on a one-to-one level. You can really do that, especially if you're alone with them. Or you don't have to be alone with them. You can be in an open setting like this, but if it's open enough, you know, you have the feeling that people aren't really listening to your conversation, and it lends itself well to one-to-one. And in a prison system, it's easier to do, I've found, than in a jail system, because many times in a jail system, you have to talk through some kind of glass. But in a prison system, it's just like this. We're in an open setting, we're sitting across a table, sometimes about the same size, and nobody's paying attention to you, and we're doing the visiting around you. It's just that way. But with relationship to what I consider the real need in our nation, I'm going to read this because it's hard for me just to memorize exactly what I want to say in a concise form. Reports indicate, and I've studied this throughout the nation, that perhaps only 10% of the correctional institution residents, and I call them residents, just a little more humane way to say it, have regular communication and or visits with caring family members or individuals. So far, one-for-one type programs in California, the largest of its kind, and Washington State's, have been able to provide volunteer visitors for less than 1% of the remaining 90% that do not get regular visits. So that's basically the need. Now the state where Leroy is from has visitation from approximately 8%. That is astounding to have visiting to that many. They used to have 50%. And in talking with Don Clausen, who's been the coordinator there for about 22 years, he doesn't know why it's dropped off, but I think, realistically speaking, it's because he's only one man and he can only do so much. He has just a stipend of a budget to work with, and he's only able to do it in the prison part-time, although it equals about full-time when he has to do a lot of homework at home to assist with the matching process of each prisoner. But in the state of Washington, where this one-to-one concept really began back in 1964, and I happened to be an official in the prison at the time that helped to okay this process, I'm saddened to see that in the state of Washington, out of 15,000 convicts, and we have a program that is supported by approximately $200,000 a year, that still less than 1% of the need is being met in the state of Washington. The state of California has 163,000 convicts right now, and they have 1,400 going in. And I've talked at length to the executive director of that program, Bill Lyon, and he says that when he started 16 years ago as the executive director, there was only 35,000 convicts 16 years ago. Now there's 163,000. Just about every year they're building a new prison there. And he feels he's the largest project of its kind in the United States of America by far. But 1,400 volunteers with a budget of $2 million a year. And that's what it takes for him to coordinate this and pretty much assure that nobody's going to get harmed through the project, because there's a lot of stuff that has to be done, counseling and so forth, to help people understand how not to be guilty of what we call sloppy agape. Because people have tried to do this on their own, and there's been disaster, and I can go into that too. There can be disaster in this if you don't know what you're doing, and if it's not coordinated correctly and properly understood. But he knows he's the largest project in the United States of America, with 1,400 people being visited now in 38 institutions, both juvenile and adult. And so, except for the great exception of South Dakota, percentage-wise, to my knowledge, in the United States of America, no state is doing more than maybe more than 1% of the need. Maybe it's dropped less than 1%. And so I say this because the need is overwhelming for somebody to come in and get involved with convicts. And from my personal experience in speaking to all the convicts through the state of Washington, 11 major institutions in this state here, and from my personal experience, I will eventually find that at least 90% of those convicts will want me to find them a Christian friend once I tell them what a Christian friend is all about. Sometimes they'll ask, well, is he a person that's going to come and cram Christ down my throat? I said, no, Christ doesn't do that. He doesn't force himself on anyone, and they won't force themselves on you. Just be open to share, to hear what they have to share with you, and they'll be open to hear what you have to share. As Christ came and spread his arms wide and said, I died for you. Is that okay? No. So it's a matter of, he did that, of course, as you know, to people who were sinners. He came to save not the righteous, but the sinners. You know? And so we've got a real easy target for reaching people for the Lord. It is just unbelievable. Yet, less than 1% of the need is being fulfilled. So the purpose that I have, my vision, is to establish positive relationships between the residents of our correctional institutions and dedicated Christian individuals and families living where the residents will most likely be residing upon release. The programs that I have seen, other than my own, don't emphasize getting a person from the area where he's going to be released to. Primarily because in most states it's a long distance, like in Washington State right here. You get a lot of convicts going to the prison in Shelton, for instance, which is about 350, 400 miles from Spokane. And so, and then you get the great bulk of the prisoners going from Walla Walla all the way to Seattle, which is another 350, 400 miles. And so, I will go to the church in Spokane, where one of the prisoners in Shelton may be released to as soon as possible when he gets into the prison. And I will let them know that there's prisoners coming out, maybe 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, maybe never, from your area. And then I will preach a sermon. And the sermon will be on Matthew 25. In Matthew 25, Jesus said, to the extent, or inasmuch, as you did what? Visited me in prison. To the extent that you did it with help and ministering care. to the extent that you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren. Now, I studied this in the Greek for years. I took Greek for 3 years in Pacific Lutheran University and seminary. And we can all read the amplified version of the Bible. I believe in studying it. The Bible doesn't say, just read it, it says study it. And I've studied it and studied it and studied it. And I believe in taking the Bible in its context. And in its context, what Jesus said in Matthew 25 was, insofar as you did it to one of the least of these in the estimation of men. The King James won't say that, because the King James, it's an excellent translation, but it doesn't say all the derivatives of meaning that the Greek points out. The Greek points out in the estimation of men. You see, you can't get too least in the mind of God. You can be the worst living being that ever lived, and if you confess your sins, He's faithful and just to forgive your sins, because you can't outstrip the grace of God, grace greater than all our sins. So I try to help people realize that Jesus equated visiting the least in the estimation of men with Himself. Perhaps it was because He went to prison, He went to death row. And He was rejected by everybody throughout, and He was rejected by His own apostles, His own disciples. And somehow He wants us to identify with those who are rejected. I have talked to literally thousands of families over the years. And even the people who are the relatives of the convicts may as well be in prison with them, because they're treated differently in the church. The wives, the brothers, the sisters, even if they have a relative in there, they're just treated slightly different. Just like, I've heard this testimony thousands of times. I had a program for 10 years called Loved Ones of Inmates. In my church in Tacoma, they gave me a special room. And they came from all different churches, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Baptist. They came to me just to help them, so that they would realize, hey, as Leroy was pointing out, they're people too. But people have, it's hard to overcome this feeling. I get rejected because I stand up for the convict, in the sense that he's a human being. I don't pat him on the back for what he did. I'm not a bleeding heart guy, in the sense that I believe in punishment. I believe it should be fast and swift. It is very slow in our country because the court systems are backed up in most cases, and it takes too long to get through the system. But I also believe that there has to be a separation in our mind between punishment and grace and love and caring. And you don't pat the prisoner on the back for what he did, but you just come in there and you recognize he's another human being just like yourself. Another human being that is, for all intents and purposes, the fatherless. What do I mean by that? I don't mean he doesn't have a father living and breathing there, but a father that won't even come to visit him or send him a letter or anything. What that does for the feeling of rejection is beyond belief. We did a study clear back in 1964 that showed that at least 90% of the guys behind bars, for all intents and purposes, were fatherless. And that's not a padded figure at all. I brought parts of the Billy Graham team. When Billy Graham came to this kingdom in 1976, he allowed me to have an office, and many people don't realize he has a pre-crusade going into the prisons, and they used me because I had quite a few volunteers involved, and they knew about my project. But I found out from that even Billy Graham understands that about 10% of those that come forward to accept Christ really stick. And somebody has done some planting and watering. Sometimes I've been to maybe 700-800 churches in the Northwest or more. I don't think I'm patting that at all. For 15 years, almost every Sunday, I was at somebody else's church on Sunday, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday night. And I'd come back and give 5-hour training sessions. But just not enough people would get involved. I had 1,000 people, 1,000 prisoners that would ask me every year. They wanted me and my wife to take them into our house. And I said, look, folks, my wife kind of frowns at taking several thousand into our living room at the time. I want to, share the blessing around. Everybody take one. I know I'm talking right now a little bit of certain elocutions, and I better stick to my script here, because there's so much to be said, but there's not enough time to say it all. Most churches will give you maybe 20, 30 minutes to talk, and I'm just starting to get wound up there. And sometimes after I've been back to the same church a half a dozen times, the people start to move out because they start to see what I'm saying. One church gave me 12 hours, if you can believe that or not. I happened to go to seminary with a man, and we had three small children together in seminary, and I had three small children. And we got a close relationship, and then he happened to get a church close to the prison where I was a supervisor, sometimes acting superintendent. And so there was about a dozen people in this church that I used to be their supervisor. And so psychologically, I had a little advantage. They trusted me, and trust is where it's at. So he started me out in the morning with the service with the adult Bible class, and then I graduated to the morning sermon, and then had lunch, and then after lunch they sat around all afternoon asking questions and so forth. And I'm pretty skeptical of this, and I don't blame skepticism on this. I would be skeptical of myself had I not worked with thousands of convicts. How do you change a mindset that's been ingrained in people all their life through the media and all this type of thing? You just don't do that overnight. But then even in the evening, we were going to 8 o'clock that evening still, so I couldn't hardly talk anymore. My voice was raw, just trying to answer all the questions and so forth. But I had my greatest allies from that group, because they now understood. They had all their questions answered. And I don't pretend to be able to answer all the questions. I don't know all the answers. I just know that in counseling and talking to about 50,000 convicts over the last 40 years, I'd have to be dead not to learn something from that. You just got to know that there's a need here. But I believe this need is so great that if we could accomplish this need, and that's my dream, to see every last person behind bars in this country receive a Christian friend who wants one. I had a project here in Washington State where I had 2,500 people go into 11 major institutions, and I think it was the largest program of its kind that's ever existed in the United States. But I was literally burning my own family out. I had 5 children. My wife didn't see me at home. I wasn't able to go to church with my own children because I had 2,500 children out here in 11 major institutions that were waiting for me to find a friend. And I'm talking about children too. I'm 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old. Sometimes kids that didn't even commit a crime, they're just between their parents who were trying to kill each other with a gun or something. And they were taken away from their parents for their own protection or by the state and put into this institution where I was their counselor. And you don't take a good apple and put them in with a bunch of, I don't mean to go against what you said, I was going to say rotten apples. I mean, they're not rotten in the sense that they can't be good people. It's just that they are kids with a bad attitude. They're very selfish, and they're very ungrateful. These are learned characteristics. And if you don't have parents that care enough to teach you these learned characteristics, use this fork and this knife, and you have certain etiquette in your life, it doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. And so I could even ask people, I go to churches and hold up 1,000 names. 1,000 a year were asking me for friends here in the state of Washington. And I think some of the people literally cower out of the church. I'd like to visit one of your people, but the good thing you're doing, goodbye. And out the door they go. Just because it's not something that people tend to go toward. But I can tell you honestly that of the 5,000 to 7,000 people I was able to recruit here over a 16-year period in the state of Washington, not one of those people ever told me I asked them to do the wrong thing. Matter of fact, they were all blessed more than the people they went to visit, and bless. And I think they changed sometimes even more than the convert. See, Jesus in Matthew 25, when he talked, he didn't say, do this if you see results. We're big business oriented. We've got to see results. But sometimes you don't see any results. Jesus himself only saw results from one of the two people on the cross next to him. It's a matter of when you do it, you're doing it unto him. If we really saw this as Jesus, like Jesus said, that's me. Of course, it wasn't him, but it was him so close that he said, that was me. When you did it to one of the least, not two or three or a dozen or more, but just to one. If we could just get that concept in our mind, that we could all just take one. And so when I go to various churches, I just share in the service, and hopefully somebody might come to my seminar. Well, I'll give 5 hours of orientation. Then maybe some of the people will get involved. I'll say more than half of them will get involved then. And I don't try to push people into this. I don't try to shame people into this. You know, Jesus, you know, I often wonder why in Matthew 25 Jesus said, well, let me read it for you just to remind you if you haven't read it lately. And I'm reading it out of the Amplified here, because I believe this is closest to the original language that you get. This is a translation. This is not a paraphrase. It says, when the Son of Man come in all his glory and his majesty and splendor, and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. So this is future. And all nations, and some translations have all peoples, will be gathered before him. And I say that partly because some people want to think that this is only written to the Jews during the tribulation. But this is not. This is not in this context at all, because he's talking to all peoples here now. And he will separate them, the people, from one another, as a shepherd separates his sheep from the goats, as it says in Ezekiel 34:17. And he will cause the sheep to stand at his right hand, but the goats on the left. Now there's no chance for a goat to become a sheep or a sheep to become a goat. And then the king, you notice this is future, because then when Jesus was speaking at this particular point in time, he was Son of Man here on earth. But in the future, he's going to be king over everything. Then the king, he's Jesus himself, our creator, the Son of God, is calling himself. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father. In other words, you're favored of God and appointed to eternal salvation. Inherit, receive as your own the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Why? Because I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you brought me together with yourselves, and welcomed and entertained and lodged me. Now, I was naked. Notice how he's making this so personal. What I was going to say was Leroy has a program where he takes in all this, all these aspects with people that come to a home in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where the wives of people or the people that come from, he can tell you about that, it's more of his program. He takes care of all these needs for the people outside of the prison. I was naked and you clothed me, and I was sick and you visited me with help and ministry and care. You see, we're not just throwing money at the program, at the problem, but on a one-to-one basis with help and ministry and care. This is what Jesus is talking about, insofar as he did to one. He doesn't say two. I think he's, the Son of God knows what to say verbally. I believe every word of this has come down exactly as it was meant to be. Now, has any of you ever heard of this book called More Than a Carpenter? Yeah, you read it. Okay. Yeah. What do you think of it?
Marvelous. I've given it to lots of folks in several languages.
I think every prisoner should receive one of these. If anybody has any doubt that the Bible is the Word of God, has come down to us the way it's meant to be said, you got to read this book. This man was a tremendous atheist. He was angry at God. He came from a real bad, broken home situation. But he's a sharp person. He's in demand all over the United States in colleges and everything. But he really has it together as far as if a person can read that and not believe the Bible is the Word of God, they can't believe, they can't trust any book that they could ever read after that. If you get a chance to read it, it's easy reading, and it doesn't take long to go through it. I think there's several, 7 million in print or something like that. It's quite a thing. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me with help and ministering care. I was in prison and you came to see me. Just think of how personal Jesus put that down. Then the just and upright will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and give you something to drink? Well, I often thought of, you know, see, this is what the Greek calls future pluperfect. In other words, it's something that's going to happen in the future. I mean, something that's going to happen that the people are going to do during the last days. Because Jesus is still answering the question put to him by his disciples at the first part of Matthew 24, of what will the signs of the end of time be. And this is his grand crescendo. This is his longest talk. You can read everything that Jesus was directly quoted as saying within a half hour in the scripture. And this is, you know, this is just before he heads to the cross to die for every one of us. And normally when a person is going to die soon, and the last words they say before they die are sometimes the most apropos for what they want us to remember. And so he's coming on pretty strong about what he feels, Jesus feels, is extremely important. But when the just and upright will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and give you food, or thirsty and give you something to drink? I thought, you know, that's funny that he's going to say that to us as the sheep in the future, when after we have already done the visitation on a one-to-one basis to him. And we're going to say, when did we do this to you, Lord? The very question on the part of the sheep implies that we did it, not because we were knowing we did it for him, and yet he's stating it here for a purpose, for us to know now that that's what we're going to say. But why is that? The only reason I can think of, maybe you can think of another reason, is because he wants to give us, each one of us personally, an indicator. What do I mean by indicator? Well, we have that thing on our car that tells us how fast we're going, that speedometer thing, you know. It has nothing to do with propelling the wheels. In other words, we're not going to get to heaven by doing these things, but it's an indicator to each one of us how much we care for what he defined as one of the least, not just the prisoner, the hungry and the thirsty. It's an indicator to us of how much we care about him. So it's my own personal indicator. How much do I really care? Do I really see this as the Lord? Now, I say that because a number of times I've recruited people, at first especially, to visit people in the various prisons and juvenile institutions throughout the state of Washington. And I'm all excited, and I'm telling the prisoner, hey, these people are just wonderful people. You're going to love them. I said, these are really lovely people. And he's all excited. I've even stood there watching as he combs his hair, sometimes for over an hour, just kind of visitor. I mean, it just takes on so much more meaning than it does to you and me, because we can go wherever we want and get what kind of visitor we want. And then they don't show up. And that's devastating. have had a hard time just trying to overcome that type of thing. And then later on you find out, well, they decided to go to a baseball game, a golf game, or something else. You know, that's why I want people to really see this as Jesus. Because if you really thought this was Jesus, if we thought this was Jesus, would we not come when we said we're not going to come? I was in charge of the chapel for years at the Washington Correction Center in Shelton. I'd see where excited evangelists would come in and they'd come forward and they'd all accept Christ, and later on I see this guy, he's starting to riot in the prison, and I said, hey, what's the big deal? I thought you accepted the Lord in your life. So I'll get off my back, and so I call him again on a one-to-one basis into my office, and I find out this pastor that came in said he'd come back and see him. Never showed up. More often than not, they won't. They're busy in their churches trying to run something there. And even to the pastors, this is not that important. And so I try to help the pastors see this. None of them ever says I'm wrong in what I say. I think some of them wish they never said it. But see, pastors themselves, many times they go to seminary, they haven't been involved with convicts, so they don't see this. Until you're involved, deeply involved, like Leroy and myself, and maybe some of you, I just congratulate you for even coming to this meeting.
They'll probably call the prison and say, hey, I'm snowed in, I can't get out, would you tell?
Exactly.
And that is really a lifesaver for these guys in prison.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, if there's some reason you can't show up, sure. You know, that's good, but just let somebody know, that's all. Yeah. I mean, just don't not show up and not say anything. You see, that's also devastating. That's so true, yeah.
And I think what you're doing there, Carl, is helpful. And that's what Don Clausen does. Anybody who volunteers to be an M2 or a W2, we have a period of preparation. We teach these people, you're not going to be their banker. You're not going to loan them any money. You're not going to be their attorney. You're not going to be involved with their legal problem. We want you simply to go in there and be a friend who will listen to them.
Exactly. Listening is the key. How you listen. You're not just looking at your watch. If you've only got an hour to visit, visit once a month, drop a note once every 2 weeks. But I teach people don't. If you've only got an hour to visit, it's the very first part. Just look for an opportunity to very naturally say, you know, I've just got about an hour to go and I'm sure glad I could come to visit you, so that you don't get up an hour later when you could have stayed 2 or 3 hours and he wondered if something he said was wrong. You'll be very, prisoners are typically very paranoid that they're, you know, that you don't really care about. They'll be questioning why you're coming in. What is your reason for doing this? And I shared yesterday with Leroy some of the mistakes I made at first, and I'd go into some of that and share with you some of those mistakes, but I think I've used up my time about now. Yeah. So I'll have
maybe
to stop.
Maybe you can throw it open for questions, Carl.
Okay. Before I do, I just want to, I've also got some of these sheets here that just very concisely show what I've said here, and I've got a sheet that shows I've got the state of Washington is open for me to do it again. I don't have a ministry going right now in the state of Washington. I've got the approval of the state to do the program if I can come with a manual. I'm working on a manual right now, like I had before. I stopped doing this because my own family was hurting. Now they're doing great. I've got my 5 children all doing wonderful. My grandchildren are doing wonderful, and they all agree that I maybe should go back into this because they know I can't shut up about it. So it's. So as Leroy said, if you have any questions, anybody have any questions or comments or anything?
Well, how do we plug into you as individual churches?
I have, on the back part of this, it shows my address here, and I can be written to by your pastor.
And that right here.
Right next to that red Amplified Bible there to the left of it, I've got these you can pick up. And it has my address at the back. And if you want to know a little more about what visitation is all about, This is one of the best, I don't know if you've seen these before, DeGroy, but this was put together by Chaplain Ray many years ago.
Texas.
But this is still very apropos. I believe he passed away quite a number of years ago. But this, the principle of it does not change. It's almost like the Bible. It does not change on the rules of visitation, what to do and what not to do, all the little details. It's almost like a little seminar itself. So feel free to pick up one of these along with this too. And you'll have the information. I have, when I was administrator of a large retirement facility called Life Manor in Tacoma for 9 years, I have some of my cards. I haven't got my cards made up so far, so I just crossed off the retirement facility, put my name and number down there so anybody can call my phone number on here. I don't have my phone number on this, but I do have my phone number on this. I just put this together because I'm just in the process of getting off the ground. I've got a lot more I can say about that. But any other questions? Yes.
Do you put women with women?
Yes.
Or can women with men?
We never pair a woman with a man. We don't do that.
How about as a couple?
Well, once the spouse, if you're a woman visiting a woman and you've got a solid relationship there, then the husband is invited to come in. This is through our project. If you're a man visiting a man, then I want the relationship solid with the man before we invite the wife. We even had one time, the wife came in too soon. She divorced. I don't want to say it was the whole denomination got turned off in the Seattle area because the woman got so infatuated with the man, she divorced her husband, who was a pastor of a large denomination, married the guy in the joint. And that was a sad thing. But that was when I made a couple mistakes. It was the worst thing that ever happened, I think. But that is something extremely rare. I don't think that's going to happen right away. Maybe one out of, it's like being struck by lightning, but something could happen like that. But I'm just saying we do that because we have to pretty much guarantee the state of Washington that we're not going to have problems like this type of thing. And I build in, and I could go into a lot of details, I build in certain stuff that makes it so that chances of any person getting harmed or something happening is like the chances of probably getting struck by lightning. It is very rare, and not one person was ever harmed or anything done to them of the 5,000 to 7,000 people over the 16-year period I did this before. Any other questions?
Well, since your time is obviously stretched pretty thin here, what kind of spade work would you like individual congregations to do before they ask you to come and talk to them?
Well, I'd like the pastor of the church, I spend a couple hours with the pastor of the church to help him understand where I'm coming from and to see where he's at with this thing. You see, if the people in the church are not prepared, because some churches I'll go there and speak and everybody listen, and I appreciate their willingness to let me share. But if the pastor is not behind me, the congregation is going to sense that, you see. And so, and that many times they're not behind me simply because the pastor himself is not sure about all this, you see. And so it depends on your church as to how strong they are about this as far as their preparation is concerned for this. Is that
what it seems to me to be a bit of a problem in the cart and the horse. I happen to be the chair of my church's adult education program. Mm-hmm. So I'm in a position to book people in to talk to our adults between services on Sundays about just about anything.
I see.
But I wouldn't want you to come and make a 50-minute presentation and then you disappear and everybody looks at each other and says, gee, that's a big problem. We ought to do something about it. And then, boom. There's another couple hours of your time shot, nothing happens.
At this exact point in time, it's a little premature to have me come.
Yeah.
Simply because right now, they're going to see, when I did this before, there was about 75 to 100 people coming through the 39 Superior Courts of the 39 counties of Washington State through Shelton, except for women and those condemned to die, they either go to the women's prison or Walla Walla. So at that time, there were 75 to 100. Now there are over 500 a month coming through. And I know from past experience that if I talk to those 500 in a month, they'll let me talk to them all in a group, and about 70% of those will fill out this application form that I've got right here, the prisoner. Well, I've got it over here right now. But they'll fill out this application, the prisoner will fill out the application saying, I want a friend. And I'm going to do that before I go to the churches to let them know what the need is. So right now, I can't say I have a need because I haven't gone back to the prisons for 16 years now. I'm just getting off the ground. The prison in South Dakota was happened to be a project that the Lord allowed me to get started 30 years ago. And that's why I was called by Leroy to come and share it right today. And Leroy wasn't even aware, I don't think, until I came here now that I didn't have a program off the ground. He just knew that the administrator of the program at South Dakota told him about me because they invited me back to South Dakota and I'm going back there again in a few days to give out awards to people that have been visiting now for over 25 years from the President of the United States, which is a great honor.
Well, thank you, Carl.
Thank you.
In South Dakota, our M2 program has a reputation. You can go, I think, into just about any congregation of any denomination now and say, what is the M2 program? And they know about it. Dr. Plossy has been around. I've been around to just about every one of our Lutheran congregations in South Dakota to talk about the program. And that Bible verse that Carl quoted, I like to think of that question, when did we see it? That ministering was such a part of their life that they weren't even, it wasn't kind of intentional. It was just such a natural part of their life to take care of the sick and all of those. And our questions, in that great parable that confrontation Jesus had with the attorney, we ask, who is my neighbor? Who is my friend? Jesus turns it around. To whom will you be a neighbor? To whom will you be a friend? And one of the greatest testimonies for this kind of a program that I've heard was when shortly after I began my ministry there was a man that I met who had been out of the prison, and he was making it. He was doing fine. I said, why haven't you come back in like so-and-so? We had one guy that was out for 3 hours, committed a new felony, and was back in. But he said, I owe it all to my M2. This man came in, and after a while, he would bring his family to meet me. And this M2 man taught me what it meant to be a Christian husband. Because when he and his wife would look at each other, I could visibly see the look of affection in their eyes. When my wife looked at me, all I saw was contempt. And his children, they would stand there with their arms around him, and they would joke with him, he'd play with them. My kids could never do that. Especially when I was drunk, they would run and hide so that I wouldn't hit them. And not only that, but my M2 man taught me that my boss has a right to expect 8 hours of honest work from me. Prior to meeting him, before I came in here, I don't think I worked an honest day in my life. I would check in, punch in, and then goof off, maybe find some place where I could read a girly magazine, sneak off for a beer, and make sure that I got back in at time to check out. I never had an honest day in my life. And so this is the kind of program, and this is the power of your presence, the gift of your presence in another human being's life. And Jesus promises to become incarnate. The Word becomes flesh. You become that flesh, that human being that ministers to those who are in prison. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming. And now, don't leave the lab.
Like to have you read it over in preparation. This won't be what we'll be discussing tomorrow, but it'll be maybe a preparation for our class tomorrow.